It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A sort of a news buzz edition, even though it's Thursday because of our holiday weekend, pushing that forward. Tomorrow, during the noon hour, we'll have some special 4th of July programming. So let's get right to it. Later in the hour, I'll talk with an Iowa State University researcher whose team is helping the Center for Disease Control forecast the spread of coronavirus in our country. Also, at the end of the hour, Stephen Gruber-Miller of the Des Moines Register, he's their State House reporter, will give us a quick walk through some of the new state laws that took effect yesterday, July 1st. But first, let's go to this. Des Moines Public Schools, like many schools in the state, never resumed classes after spring break back in March, 4 months ago. About 4 months ago. Has it been that long? Evidently, it has. Now, with the typical refrain of back to school on our horizon, returning to school will be anything but typical. So this half hour, we want to explore how students can return to learn, come back safely in the middle of this pandemic. Let's start this half hour with Grant Gerlach, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Grant, hi. How are you doing?
Hi, Ben. I'm good.
So from your reporting, I see that Iowa schools are sharing more information about what classes could look like when students return next month. Give us, first of all, a big picture of what you found out, what things will look like.
Yeah, what they could look like, because a lot could change between now and when classes start, around 6 weeks from now. But schools had to submit these return to learn plans to the State Department of Education, and every school had to figure out a few different things. They needed to show that they had thought about how to have classes in person, if that's possible. They needed to show they had thought about how to have all virtual classes, all learning from home, if that's necessary. Mm-hmm. And they also need to have some idea of how to have a combination of the two. So either students splitting time in class or splitting weeks in class, some way for them to spend some time at school learning and some time learning at home. So those are the sort of the three different pieces schools needed to put some notes together on to share with the state. But these aren't necessarily the last word on all of this. There are still a lot of decisions to make. Schools haven't necessarily committed to one version or another. They're just sort of preparing and waiting to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. As you've surveyed this and talked with school superintendents, we'll talk with the Des Moines school superintendent in just a moment, we'll add him, but what have you found in this big picture to be the most difficult issues that school districts in the state are struggling with?
Well, space, I think, is one of the biggest things. Space in the classrooms. Some schools are very full, and so it's hard to imagine bringing a full classroom of students back and trying to maintain at least 6 feet of distance at the same time. Buses, they try to be as efficient as possible when they're transporting students from one place to another. But if they're trying to distance students on the bus, that really limits their capacity to move students around. So lunchtime, it's a time when you cram students into the cafeteria, get everybody fed, but you can't do that. So schools are having to go really from through the day, moment by moment, to look at what school usually looks like and then imagine what that can look like when you're providing safe distancing and other protective measures like masks or face masks or plastic barriers between people, all the different measures they're going to have to take to try to keep people apart as much as possible. So space is a big one. And then if things have to go virtual at some point, there are still large barriers for technology. One district I talked to adopted an online education platform for the first time, and they're, like many districts, trying to make sure they can get devices in the hands of at least every family, if not every student, to make sure that if they do have to change what they're doing because of the status of the pandemic, that they're still able to provide distance learning because they have to. In the spring, that could be voluntary, but this year it's not going to be voluntary. It's going to be mandatory for every student, even if they have to learn from home.
Okay, Grant Gerlach, Iowa Public Radio reporter, stay with us on the line. We also have with us this half hour, Thomas Ahart is superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools. Superintendent Ahart, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
You just heard Grant Gerlach outline sort of the big picture here. When your students return to Des Moines Public Schools, what will it look like specifically?
Well, I want to say Grant did a great job of describing the context, I think. In Des Moines, we're offering a fully virtual experience for those families that that don't feel comfortable sending their children back to school physically like they did last fall. We've done extensive surveying of our families as well as our staff and students, and we're anticipating somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% of our students selecting the fully virtual model. So we will have some staff, we'll be expanding our already existing virtual campus that's been in place for a couple of years, that has been serving high school and that will be serving kindergarten through 12th grade. And then for everyone else, it will be really what we're calling a hybrid model. So for our elementary schools, which are kindergarten through fifth grade, and our middle schools that are sixth grade through eighth grade, students will be divided into two groups, if you will, an A group and a B group. So the A group will attend school with their A group cohorts on Mondays and Tuesdays, and everyone will be virtual on Wednesdays, which will provide an opportunity for our staff to thoroughly clean and disinfect the environment before Group B comes in on Thursday and Friday. At the high school level, it will look a little bit different. Wednesdays will be fully virtual for everyone, just as they are in the lower grades. Ninth grade students will attend their home school on Mondays and sophomores on Tuesdays, juniors on Thursdays, and seniors on Friday. And then many of our high school students also attend classes at Central Campus. And so they will also be attending their Central Campus classes, but in the opposite sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
we all remember
a real thumbnail sketch.
We all remember our elementary school. Talking about the younger kids in your school district, you know, elementary school involves a lot of close proximity, touching, and you know, whatever you're doing, a lot of activities between kids that depend on that. So, give us a sense of how you think that will look, especially in the younger categories of students.
Well, it's definitely going to be a challenge, not only for the staff, but for the students as well. You know, we're trying to navigate, all of the schools in Iowa are really trying to navigate two challenges that that largely appear to be mutually exclusive, protecting the health and safety of in our case, 33,000 students and about 5,000 staff, working in close proximity, while at the same time trying to educate all of those students, in addition to trying to make up for lost opportunities this last spring. So it's really a conundrum that everyone's facing. So it will feel different for sure, especially for our younger ones. We will have fewer than half the number of students in a classroom as they had last year. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have some relatively speaking strict protocols in terms of movement within the classroom, as well as regimented routines for when students can use restroom facilities. And as Grant had mentioned, we won't be able to have all of our students in the cafeteria for breakfast and lunch, and so those will take place within their classroom as well.
Right. You mentioned that the students, the parents of these students have the opportunity to have a completely and have chosen to have a completely virtual experience for their child or children. What about the teachers? Especially we have, of course, teachers in various ages, but also in higher risk categories when it comes to the COVID virus. What options do the teachers have? What have you had to have in terms of discussions and with teachers so that they also feel comfortable in this new environment?
Yeah, great question. So we've had pretty broad engagement from all employee groups in developing this plan. We've been you know, testing different models on paper and continue to run into roadblocks. And so while the plan that we have right now is by no means ideal, we do think it's about as good as we can do, given all of the public health requirements that we need to follow or that we ought to follow to protect the health and safety of the students and the staff. So with our staff, as I said, we have about 5,000 staff, a little bit shy of that number. And we have about 1,400 staff members who have what would qualify as a pre-existing condition that would complicate their concerns if they were to contract COVID-19. So we're trying to get really creative with how we address those challenges. As I said, we have we're projecting about 10% of our students selecting a virtual option, and so we do have an existing teaching staff for a virtual campus, but that clearly will need to be expanded pretty dramatically. And so those teachers that cannot safely return to the regular classroom under these conditions will likely be providing service in our virtual setting. Staffing will look considerably different in a number of ways, and so we will also have additional needs that some of those staff can help us with in reaching out to those students that that are learning remotely, because all of our students will be learning remotely to some degree or other, and we need to ensure that we're keeping those students and those families engaged, and that nobody's getting lost in this new environment where there's not nearly as much physical contact as we've traditionally been used to.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Thomas Ahart with us, Superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools, Grant Gerlach, our reporter here, been covering a lot of the education issues as we look to next month and the return to learning safely, we hope for sure. Superintendents, what about masks? Of course, a big debate, contentious in our country, politicized in our country. I think some of the school districts in Iowa are saying they plan to require face coverings at school. Are you?
We are, yes. You know, it's unfortunate that topic has been, as you said, politicized. We're trying to do is follow best practice as much as is possible. And if we don't require face coverings, then we're not doing the single most important step that we can take to mitigate the impact of the spread of the virus. And so, you know, there will be some health exceptions to that, but we're going to be pretty high and tight on requiring face coverings because, and I talked about this a bit in the spring, you know, when we're fully engaged in business in the district, we have about 40,000 individuals going in and out of the doors of our schools on any given day. And one case, one diagnosis that we don't manage properly can quickly turn into a vector that spreads all over central Iowa.
Yeah,
so we feel a special responsibility in that regard.
Yeah, but at the same time, then explain how the Iowa Department of Education, I understand, advises against the mandatory use of face coverings at school because it points to legal and training issues? You're not on the same page there with the Iowa Department of Education.
No, we're not in this instance. You know, I've been in conversation with my colleagues from around the country and various state approaches to return to learn relative to the pandemic vary pretty widely, with some states like Texas providing very clear and focused guidance for expectations for schools. And then there are states like Iowa that are leaving things very broadly up to individual school districts, which puts us in a pretty unique circumstance. Conditions also, you know, vary from community to community, from county to county, and the size of districts also makes a difference. So we aren't on the same page with the guidance, although I will say that we are legally, we are able to exceed the guidance, in this case with face coverings. And we just feel like if we don't make that requirement, we'll likely be forced to go virtual at a number of our schools, just because one case can quickly and very rapidly spread to hundreds of cases. And in addition to, you know, almost right around 1,400 of our staff with pre-existing conditions, we also serve a large number of students that that have health conditions that make them particularly vulnerable to the negative impact of a COVID-19 diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. One more voice, Superintendent Nehart. I want one more voice to add to this conversation before we wind up in about 5 minutes. Dr. Fred Gehr is with us, University of Iowa Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health, Critical Care and Occupational Medicine. Dr. Gehr, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. We don't have much time, so we'll cut right to it. You've been listening to the conversation we've had thus far this half hour. As a public health expert, what are your main concerns? And there are so many when kids return to school in a few weeks' time.
It's a pretty broad question you've asked there. My main concern, of course, is controlling the spread of COVID-19 among students and between students and staff. And there are a number of ways of preventing spread. Superintendent Ehart has touched on a number of them, but in a sense, the big five are social distancing, which is 6 feet or more, the use of cloth face coverings, regular hand hygiene, disinfection of the environment, so frequently touched surfaces, and then monitoring of symptoms and preventing contact or entry of persons who have any one of a handful of symptoms that are highly indicative of COVID-19.
How do the health risks faced by the younger people, the students in this case, compare with those faced by the staff and the teachers in these schools, Dr. Gehr?
Yes. It's been very well established that younger persons and public school-aged people tend to have milder disease and fewer complications. And there's a couple of points to be made there. First, not all of them have mild disease, and not all of them are complication-free. So there are children who get this disease and become very, very ill. In addition, it's true that in general, children have milder disease, but those same children then go home to adult-aged family members and have the potential, I think Superintendent Ehart used the word vector earlier, but those same children then become a route of transmission of the virus to others who are much more likely to develop severe disease and to have severe and long-term complications. So the goal, of course, is to protect everybody, students, adults, everyone, both in the classroom and then outside of the classroom as well.
Mm-hmm. When we look to the fall and, you know, the best laid plans of all the different school districts in Iowa, I wonder, Dr. Gehr, if you're forecasting, I'm trying to think of the scenarios that we will possibly be reporting on in the fall. Hopefully everything will go well. But one scenario, isn't it, is that we have something similar to nursing homes, where we have a particular school, an outbreak in a particular school, which becomes sort of a super spreader school. Am I worrying too much there? Do you foresee that possibly happening?
Yes, I do foresee that possibly happening. And frankly, given how serious this illness is, given the way it's spreading, I'm not sure it's possible for you or anyone else to worry too much, as you just suggested. I think that we need to have an extremely high level of vigilance. And I think that it's entirely possible that one or more schools will become a focus of infection, and it may become necessary for those particular schools to go to full virtual instruction. And I read the Des Moines School District document, Return to Learn, and I thought it really was very responsive to public health concerns and very appropriate from a public health perspective in the ways that Des Moines Community School District is making efforts to protect students, to protect staff, and to protect the community. And I think that the option of going full virtual is an important option to retain should a school become a site of a particularly high rate of transmission of the virus.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute or so left. Back to Superintendent Ahart. What are your contingencies should you have one of these schools, one or more schools in the Des Moines Public School District become very problematic? What is your plans then?
Great question, Ben. So this past spring, we distributed over 20,000 laptop computers to students so that all of our students had a device and also that were connected. We actually provided around 5,000 internet connections to families this past spring. So part of the reasoning behind the in-person plan, where all of the K-8 and all the high school students, even if they're in person for 2 days a week, will be learning virtually at least one day a week, is to be better prepared to pivot individual buildings' ability to pivot to completely virtual in the event that we need to make that change and not have any lost time. So our intention is we're actually moving to a complete one-to-one model. So preschool through 12th grade students will be provided a device that will be with them at all times, and we'll continue to keep all of our families connected.
We've run out of time. Superintendent Thomas Ahart of the Des Moines Public Schools, Dr. Fred Gehr of the University of Iowa, and Grant Gerlach of Iowa Public Radio, of course. Thank you all for the discussion. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome.
Coming up in just a moment, an Iowa State University researcher helping the CDC forecast the spread of the coronavirus. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, with the latest resurgence of COVID-19 cases in the U.S., also here in the Midwest to some extent, the big question we all have is, how long will we have to live with the threat of this pandemic? Lily Wong is an associate professor of statistics at Iowa State University in Ames. She's leading a research team whose statistical models are helping the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, track and predict COVID-19 deaths in this country. Lily Wong joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for having me today.
I think it's best if you introduce us quickly to the idea of scientific modeling. What is a scientific model in this case?
An essential question for developing defense against the COVID-19 is to understand how far the virus will spread and how many lives it will claim. In the early stage of an outbreak, especially when the outbreak is fast moving like the coronavirus, there are many uncertainties. So it's not clear to anyone where the crisis will lead us. One way to answer these questions is through scientific modeling. So scientific models are critical planning tools for policymakers, public health practitioners, and even for families and citizens. Scientific models can help to see when the peak will occur and whether resurgence will happen, and can give you inference about intervention efficacy.
Mm-hmm. So you are trying to do with this coronavirus something similar to a forecast. We all think of weather forecasts. So it would be nice to know what will happen in the future for a variety of reasons with this. So specifically to your modeling, your statistical modeling, what specifically are you working on right now for the CDC?
So basically, scientists up till now still don't know everything about how this virus is transmitted. And also due to the lack of widespread testing, we also don't know exactly how prevalent it is. We don't know if the virus will lead or show a strong seasonal effect. So there are a lot of uncertainties coming with the virus. It's very challenging to measure and model contact rates between susceptible and infectious people, not only under physical distance policies, but also in various reopening scenarios. So we established a new spatial temporal epidemic modeling framework to study the dynamic pattern in the spread of COVID-19 at the county level.
Mm.
Our proposed methodology can be used to dissect the spatial structure and dynamics of the spread, as well as to assess how this outbreak may unfold through time and space.
So how will these results be used? I understand you, it was only a few weeks ago that you got it, you started with this modeling. Of course, the pandemic has been around now about 4 months. What part of what you're doing will be used, and will we, in fact, benefit from this?
Our model can be used to help identify the factors that contributed to the spread of COVID-19. So we can help to identify the vulnerable communities and discover the reasons for those communities that are more likely to be infected. I think this is very crucial for the policy and decision makers to assist in prevention efforts and ultimately stop the pandemic.
What are the hardest variables you're dealing with, the biggest areas of uncertainty?
Oh, there are actually quite a lot of uncertainties. I think the most difficult one we are facing now is the quality of the data, especially the data collection process. So we realize there are some quality issues such as underreporting, delayed reporting, and inconsistencies between state and county sources. We also noticed there could be sudden decreases in newly confirmed cases and newly confirmed death count on weekends, which might be due to the reduced testing on the weekends. So a testing, without widespread testing, we also are not sure the data we got is trustable. So this is one type of uncertainty that we are facing now.
How many other research teams, statistical modeling teams, are out there working with the CDC, similar to yours?
CDC now works with partners to bring together weekly forecasts for the COVID-19 death count. So these forecasts have been developed independently by several research teams. Right now, maybe I think around 15 teams. The results are shared publicly. We are honored to be one of the teams providing CDC with such kind of a forecast.
Professor Lily Wong, Associate Professor of Statistics at Iowa State University, thank you very much. Very interesting, very important work you're doing there at ISU at this time. Lily Wong's research team is developing statistical models to help the CDC more accurately assess how the coronavirus will impact the nation. Professor Wong, thank you very much for explaining some of your very important work to us.
Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, finally today, a number of new Iowa laws took effect yesterday, July 1st. Among them, laws concerning voter identification, medical marijuana, police misconduct, and many others. Let's find out more about some of these new Iowa laws from Stephen Gruber Miller. He's State House reporter for the Des Moines Register. So nice to have you back on the program, Stephen. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Okay, let's see how many of these we get to in the remaining time we have in our hour. Let's have you tell us about the new voter ID requirements first.
That's right. So, yeah, as you said, several state laws went into effect yesterday. One of them was a provision in the state budget that adds in some requirements about regarding voter ID, specifically for absentee ballots. This has to do with whether county auditors are allowed to use an existing voter identification database to look up any missing information if you request an absentee ballot. Currently, they are allowed to use it. This new law changes that so that instead of using this existing database, if there's missing information when you request an absentee ballot, the auditor now has to contact you by phone or email and then physical mail if that doesn't work, rather than using that database.
Mm-hmm. And what are the implications? What are the implications of that?
Yeah, so, you know, opponents of this say that that will make it harder. It'll slow down the process, right? Instead of using that existing information and being able to get you your ballot right away, the auditor will have to get back in touch with you. You'll have to get back in touch with them. So it just adds steps to the process that they say could slow things down, and people could, you know, either something gets lost in the mail or they give up and aren't able to request that ballot. This exact provision was an administrative rule implementing the 2017 voter ID law, and it was actually struck down by a court as an administrative rule. And so the legislature has put this back into the actual law now. And so a group of Democratic-aligned lawyers have said that they're likely to sue over this again.
How did it get attached to the budget?
Right. So there was a separate law dealing with elections, but this was added in, you know, sort of at the last minute to the budget, at just part of a last minute deal. Sometimes these negotiations happen, and lawmakers are able to put something in the budget that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be in there.
I see. Okay. Medical marijuana. Iowa in the past few years has seen incremental changes, opening, loosening of the medical marijuana laws. And Kim Reynolds, our governor, signed into law a series of changes to our state medical marijuana program. What are they?
That's right. So this bill, it adds some new conditions to the program, and it also changes the amount of THC that patients are able to receive. So the new conditions that it adds are post-traumatic stress disorder. You can now be on the program for that, as well as a severe form of autism where there's a danger of injuring yourself. And it changes untreatable pain to chronic pain. So it expands some of those conditions. And then the way that it changes the THC, the program previously allowed products to be sold that had 3% THC. The new law says that it changes it to a per-patient limit of 4.5 grams over 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, critics of this provision actually say that it could result in patients being able to receive less than they currently do, and they might actually have to supplement that with other pain medications, opioids perhaps, because it's not allowing them to get as strong of medication on this program as before.
Right. Stephen, I'm interested in your view as someone who's covered medical marijuana in this state for years as a statehouse reporter for the Des Moines Register, about where this trajectory is going, do you think, when you talk with lawmakers, where do they see it going, this gradual opening that Iowa has been having over the past few years, allowing medical marijuana now to be produced in the state? It didn't initially allow that. And then we have states, our neighbor, Illinois, has allowed now recreational marijuana since January 1st of this year. So what are your thoughts on the trajectory of where our laws in Iowa may be headed?
I think you've kind of hit on one of the key uncertainties, right, which is that the viability of the business here in Iowa when there are surrounding states like Illinois that are starting to legalize recreational marijuana. There aren't a ton of people in Iowa's program. It's fewer than 5,000 people have cards that are patients on this program. And some of the companies that were involved in the program have dropped out of it just this year. So whether this new law allows more business to be done or is more restrictive, but it kind of remains to be seen. One of the companies that my colleague and I spoke with, you know, the CEO, he was hopeful that the new conditions would allow more people to be on the program, but you know, again, apprehensive about this new THC limit. So mm-hmm. I think there is a lot of uncertainty when other states are doing things differently. And Iowa has been very slow compared to many other states
right.
in expanding its law. Even last year, Governor Reynolds vetoed a bipartisan expansion of the medical marijuana program that would have allowed much higher THC limits. And she wasn't comfortable with that. And so I think there's some reluctance to go very far along that road from lawmakers, and we'll see what it means for the business side.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another new law. Of course, the massive protests across the country that actually became worldwide protests after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We have new Iowa laws following all the protests we've had across in Des Moines, but across the state against police violence. Tell us, what was the result in terms of lawmaking from all these protests?
Right. There was one major piece of legislation that lawmakers passed this year that addresses police misconduct. It does a few different things. It bans most police chokeholds. It allows the Iowa Attorney General to investigate any time an officer causes a death, whether or not the local county attorney decides to bring charges in that case. And it also essentially sets up new screening measures to prevent officers with a history of misconduct from being hired in Iowa. And it mm-hmm. requires regular de-escalation and implicit bias training for law enforcement. So mm-hmm. those are some of the things that it does. It passed really in a whirlwind one-day marathon. The bill was introduced on the floor, passed unanimously out of both the House and the Senate all in the same day, and then was signed by the governor the next day. So very quick action on that, but a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiation between Democrats and Republican leaders to put this package together. And they all say that it's a first step, essentially.
Right. And I understand that the day that this law was written and passed was unusual at the State House. How did you experience that day? What are your reflections about it? Because it was not typical, also because the minority party, the Democrats, were the ones who brought it into existence, didn't they?
Yeah, the principles in this bill are ones that Democrats had outlined at a press conference that they were looking to pass into law, and essentially they took that as the starting point, negotiated with Republican leaders, like I said, to get to the final product, which is a little bit different than what they had initially proposed. But yeah, I mean, like I said, it was done as a leadership bill, which essentially means that leadership introduced it right at the last minute, I guess. And essentially, it passed very quickly. There was some passionate debate. Iowa's five Black House lawmakers talked about some of the reasons that they were so proud to see it, things that they didn't believe they would ever see, I guess, progress like this happening. And then the next day when the governor signed it, she was on the steps of the Capitol with nearly every one of Iowa's lawmakers standing behind her, as well as advocacy groups like the NAACP and a crowd of Black Lives Matter protesters who raised their fists in the air and chanted Black Lives Matter every mm-hmm. time she signed a letter of the bill into law. So
right.
it was really an extraordinary scene.
Mm-hmm. Related to that, of course, Black Lives Matter still pushing for, where are we with felon voting law? Iowa, the last state, the only state that doesn't give felons who've served their time automatic voting rights again, right?
That's right. So as you probably know, there was a constitutional amendment proposed in the legislature to allow people with felony convictions who have served their sentences to regain the right to vote, which they currently can't do without applying to the governor. That constitutional amendment did not advance through the legislature, and the governor has said she will sign an executive order to that effect, right, allowing people to vote in time for the November election. The Black Lives Matter protesters have really been urging her to sign it this week. They want her to sign it by July 4th, and so that there is time to get people registered to vote again, educate them on the process. There's about 60,000 people in Iowa who don't have the right to vote because of a past felony conviction. And so they want to make sure that those people have time to get into the process.
Right. The magnitude of this is amazing. 60,000. I had read 30,000, but it's 60,000 Iowans this affects.
That's right. And that includes about 1 in 10 African-American adults in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Our time is slipping away. Stephen, let's get to some other laws. If you've just joined us, Stephen Gruber-Miller with me, State House reporter for the Des Moines Register, talking about some of the new laws that went into effect July 1st yesterday. Of course, far too many to cover in this short time, but let's march forward. This week, the governor signed a 24-hour waiting period for abortions. Tell us about this law. And here again, this has had some legal problems already, hasn't it?
That's right. So actually, this is one law that's currently not in effect because the governor did sign it on Monday. But on Tuesday, a judge issued a temporary injunction stopping that from going into effect while a lawsuit is being argued. So Planned Parenthood of the Heartland has sued over this. They sued a couple of years ago over a longer 72-hour waiting period and were successful in the Iowa Supreme Court. So this current challenge essentially says that the law, which is very similar, it's the same kind of waiting period as was previously struck down. They say it creates similar burdens for women to have to get abortions. They'll have to go to the clinic for an appointment, come back 24 hours later. So there are hurdles for travel and things like that. And then they also say that the way the law was passed was unconstitutional. So that's a new part of this challenge. Essentially, they say that because the abortion waiting period was attached to a separate unrelated bill at the last minute, didn't allow time for public debate, they say that that violated the rules and that it should be struck down because of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, on to something that's less well-known, less reported about that you have in your reporting, animal abuse penalties. Tell us what the law changes are there.
Yeah. Iowa has long been considered to have some of the weakest penalties for animal abuse in the country, so this strengthens them somewhat. It's the product of a couple of years of negotiation. There's been pushes and sort of hurdle like setbacks for this for a while now, but it essentially steps up penalties for neglecting, abusing, torturing animals, specifically companion animals, so not livestock or anything like that. It also sort of clarifies some of the definitions of what counts as neglect and what counts as torture so that it's easier to determine when someone has committed that crime. So it's not as much as some of the advocates and supporters for stronger legislation had been looking for, but it is stronger than Iowa's current law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, law related to our pandemic, liability protections. So what is this about?
This was a major priority of Republicans coming back from the legislature was paused for 2.5 months because of the coronavirus. And when they came back, the main COVID-19 related priority that they had was to essentially protect businesses and healthcare providers like nursing homes and hospitals from what they call frivolous lawsuits. Right? It's harder to sue them over COVID-19 now. And essentially, if you want to sue, somebody has to have been hospitalized or died, or you can sue if you can prove that the business intended to make someone sick. So it puts mm-hmm. a higher hurdle in place.
Mm-hmm.
And critics say that really it will allow bad actors to get off without any penalty for their bad behavior.
I wanted to have you remind us of the law now limiting the Secretary of State's emergency powers, the Secretary of State, a Republican, Paul Pate. Interesting, a Republican dominated government limiting the power of a Secretary of State who's in their own party. But this has to do with the way we may vote in November, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. So during the June 2nd primary, Secretary Paul Pate really took some extraordinary steps to make it easier for people to vote during the coronavirus pandemic, and that included mailing request forms for absentee ballots to every registered voter in Iowa. So every voter got those forms in the mail and could choose whether to request a ballot. It led to record turnout for a primary election. More than 530,000 people voted. So the law that the legislature passed restricts the secretary's ability to do that without first getting permission from a group of lawmakers. And that group is currently controlled by Republicans who control the legislature. So it's unclear whether Pate will ask to mail ballot request forms to every voter in the fall or whether he'll be allowed to by this group of lawmakers. It makes some other changes as well, but that was the most high profile of them.
Right. And I suppose that depends on we're seeing an increase in the number of COVID-19 cases right now. How it develops in the coming weeks may be playing into that decision. Okay, we've run out of time. Stephen Gruber-Miller, thank you. thank you so much. Statehouse reporter for the Des Moines Register. Always enjoy reading your well-researched reporting, and it's even more fun, I have to say, to talk to you in person. Stephen Gruber Miller, thanks again.
Thanks very much, Ben.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.